Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're not starting now. Now we're bloody recording and we're off. It's been a roller coaster of a morning, I can tell you that. And now we are hitting the airwaves hard. And I don't mean the eucalyptus-flavoured chewing gums. So here we are. Nat is Nat's finishing off some last-minute details on his phone. And now he's with us. Here he is. No, he's back on his phone. Maybe someone's replied. Now he's back.
Right in the room.
I was just holding the fort there. Sorry, guys. Here we are. My name is Nick. This is
Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you are listening to Nick and
Nathaniel Metcalf, sir.
Fan club. It's not just in case we've got new listeners here. It's not our fan club. It's not a club that celebrates us. It's we own it. We run it.
Mm.
So, we're like very much like Jeff at Biker Grove, and you are PJ and Duncan and Spuggy. Use the club all you like, but please don't smoke in the building. And look after the pool table. Put the sticks where you found them. Because if you leave them on like a... just lying around, people sit on them and they snap, and then that's extra work for me and Nat to do. But yeah, apart from that, just fill your boots. It should be a bit fun. We're open till 5:30, and then it's home time. So, first rule of fan club.
Tell your friends.
Tell your friends about fan club, isn't it? It's simple. We say it over and over and again, but it's like, first rule of fan club, tell your friends about fan club. The second rule of fan club.
Please, for the love of God, tell your friends.
About?
Fan club.
About fan club, isn't it? Just tell your friends about fan club. So, I think that's all of the ad ministerial duties out of the way, Daniel.
Well, one other little bit, I suppose, it's sort of a regular feature, is to say we're currently 68 in Malta this week, but we couldn't remember if that was up or down from last week.
I think, weren't we like 64 last week?
Oh, that's no good.
I've got a feeling it might. I've got a feeling it's down. Or maybe we're 67, but I think it's down by a little bit.
Did ask all our Maltese people to listen and last week and tune in, but it sounds like they haven't been.
That is a real shame. To specifically ask an entire country to do you a favour.
Yeah,
and almost like, they've willfully done the opposite.
Yeah. I don't think we ask a lot of people.
Although it does remind me of Edinburgh 2004,
mm-hmm.
where I had a show with my friend Rob called Love Life. We were on at C venues, but an out-of-the-way one. I think we were in, like, Indigo Bar. We did it, I think we were on probably about like, we were either on about 9:30 or 11-ish. It was like an evening one, but it wasn't midnight because I'd done midnight before. And we would flyer every day. Rob was a terrible flyer. And I hated flyering, but I did it. But Rob hated it. He was good on stage, but in terms of promoting stuff, it was tough. So we would promote every day, and we would get very small audiences, 3, 4. I don't think we cancelled, but once we did it in front of a mum and her son. I think they were Americans. I was going to say an American couple, but there was two Americans. Maggie was the mum, and Dylan was the son. And they sat there, and every time we did a joke, it was a tiny venue, So it's cabaret seating, but I think there was about two rows of cabaret seating where they were sat right against the flat wall. It was like it was wider than it was longer, you know, story of my life. And they were sat on the front row right in the middle, and we came out on stage. So we were about, I would say, maximum 3 feet away from them while we performed this entire hour of comedy. It was a play, but it was sort of like a loose play. It was like a presentation spoof, you know. It was like a PowerPoint presentation spoof. It was called Love Life. It was about the world's youngest self-help specialists who had fallen out with each other years ago and years later had decided to team up to do one last hurrah. Because one of them had a breakdown and the other one was trying to help them out, right? That was the... And then it was a PowerPoint show which sort of, like, fell apart. Gurus, self-help gurus. And Maggie and Dylan were sat in the front row, and all the way through it, she would shake her head and and just go... And Dylan just looks embarrassed because they were.
What did that head shaking mean, though? What does that mean? Was she enjoying it?
No, it meant that she. I think she really didn't enjoy it.
Okay.
And then afterwards, they stopped around, and I think they bought us some drinks. But I'm not even. I think they were so felt so sorry for us. It wasn't even alcoholic drinks. I think it was like. Would you like some sort of tea or some hot chocolate? Do you know what I mean? Like comforting. Do you want something comforting? We're not going to celebrate with you, but we might buy something comforting, tell you where you're going wrong. The whole festival was like that. Not the whole festival was like that.
In the early days of stand-up, you'd often do open mic nights, and you'd have a thing where, you know, no one really ought to go to an open mic night, in a way, if you're an audience.
Well, isn't a comedian.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's you're not going to enjoy it, really. But like, and you would quite understandably regularly have nights that got pulled, no one turned up. But occasionally you'd have one where you would have three people turn up. And then there would be this sort of thing of, hey guys, do you want the show to go ahead? And I always think at that point, they can't say no. If they look around and think we're the only ones here, they can't say no because it makes them look bad. It's like, oh no, I'm not doing this. And so they always go, yeah, no, go for it. Yeah, it'll be fun. We're the only ones in the audience. And what they don't know is it won't be fun. And they essentially have to do all the heavy lifting for like desperate comedians.
It's going to be comedians that don't have enough stage. I mean, we haven't got, it's not going to be like a lineup of Mike Bubbins.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who can just like smash out a Vegas style performance in front of one person. It's like, it's going to be a bunch of people that are scared, that are desperate not to have to do it, that are all going to come out and tailor make an entire evening to the three people that have bothered to show up. And one of them will be more up for it than the other two. And so the whole night will be about them. It's more of kind of like, I think if there's more people on stage than off, cancel.
Absolutely. Just no one just doesn't need to go ahead. It's fine.
I always say, look, we're here now. We can all just have a drink.
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's not do this. Let's not
put each other through this.
Because it's the tipping point is different. It's gone from we're putting on a show for our audience to an individual asking another individual to entertain them for an evening.
Yeah.
You know, a stranger. Just saying, nah, I'm here, you do it. And they sit in silence and what? It's like, it's an unfair balance. It becomes kind of like servitude. but my point was, one day, me and Rob went out and we flyered from midday right the way through. And I've never really mastered flyering. I guess you fly at all parts of the day, but I guess really the hour before your show is like the best time to do it because it's people making last minute decisions. But we flyered all day that day, you know, we waited backstage and we just thought, well, we must get an audience today. This is what every single show I did in Edinburgh was like up until 2009. And even that year, one of my shows was a sellout and the other one we cancelled 50% of the run. Because no one showed up. And when they did show up, it was three people and a reviewer. It was just like... So Edinburgh is really... Edinburgh, if you're a young comedian and you're kind of like either starting Edinburgh or just about to get into Edinburgh, I'm really grateful that I had no audiences for the first 10 years of my career, because when I did get audiences, I was so fucking grateful. And I think some people that get audiences right for... or get success right from the beginning, they don't realise that. Every time I had a sellout audience since, I've just been very grateful. And it hasn't been every time. but my point was, we fired all day and we didn't get, I think we got three people in.
So and then the next would be the day, same.
The next day we were like absolutely broken hearted. And I don't think we were broken hearted, but we were just like, well, what is the fucking point? We've been doing Edinburgh. It was 2004. So this was our third show that we'd done together. 2001, 2002, nothing 2003, couldn't afford it. 2004. Third show we'd done together. And we were just like, well, I don't know how to get an audience. It's just, it doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason. And because we've been, it was halfway through the run, or maybe two thirds through the run, we were exhausted. We were just like, well, what's the fucking point? And as a treat, I said, because it was just the two of us up there, we can have the day off. And we didn't do any flyering at all. And it was just like, worst case scenario, no one shows up and we can have the night off because this is bullshit. And, we came out on stage and it was a sold out audience the day we didn't flyer. and so I don't know why that is, but it might have been a delayed reaction from the day before where we'd flyered all day and everyone that we flyered had plans that night, but went, do you know what though? We'll see it tomorrow. And then they all came to see it tomorrow. Or it might have been just the fact that we put off more people than we encourage. So I think that what's happening with Malta might be that. We really went above and beyond last week. Mm-hmm. The Maltese people have done what we've asked and they've all gone out and they've said, you've got to really boost Nick and Nat up into the top 10. That's the aim. And that's our aim for the next 6 weeks, isn't it? Just to get... Did we say six weeks or 4 weeks? It was to get into Malta's top 10. And I think what's happened here is if we've taken a step backwards, we've got a new message. Does that say where we were last week, or is that just Natalie off the...
Oh, I don't know if I've got this message.
Yeah, it's Natalie's off topic again. So I think... what may have happened is either the people of Malta are worse flyers than me and Rob, and they've put people off, or they're great flyers and the people of Malta are really up for it, but they were busy this Friday, but next Friday is the day that they're going to do it.
Okay, well next week. So I think if you're listening in Malta, you haven't blown your chances. Just get listening.
You're still our favourite listenership, and if anyone else feels like left out, tell your friends, you know, not that you feel left out about our show, and then get yourselves up into the top 10. Top 60 will do for now, but like top 10. I mean, it sounds needy to spend the first 15 minutes of a podcast begging people to listen to your show. But I've heard other podcasts and that's pretty much standard, I think.
We're not asking you for money, though, which a lot of them do.
Which a lot of them do. We are literally just two guys. It's not even a podcast. It's a radio show that later becomes a podcast. Just want to get that clear. If it were a podcast, we'd be raking it in, especially from Malta.
Yeah.
So that's that. That's Fan Club. So Nathaniel, I feel like I haven't seen... I haven't seen much this week, weirdly. I feel like I've not really seen much this week. How about you? What have you been?
I've seen quite a lot. I saw a film I'd not seen. I saw 2003's Intolerable Cruelty by the Coen brothers, which is one of the ones that I always find this, that it's when it came out, I remember people saying it's not very good.
Hang on a minute. You saw Intolerable Cruelty for the first time?
For the first time, yeah.
This week?
This week.
Okay, right, yeah. That's mind-blowing to me, but go on.
I thought it was great as well. Or it's, you know, it's very good, very enjoyable. I remember it being one of them ones that everyone was like, nah, it's rubbish. It's not a proper one.
2003 would have come out. Okay, so Fargo was 96, Big Lebowski was 98.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they're sort of like at their height. But I think people were disappointed with Big Lebowski as well, though, weren't they?
Yeah, initially, when that came out.
Oh, Brother, Why Art Thou was 2000, was it? Or 2001?
Yeah, about then.
So this was their follow-up to Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah.
I would say that it feels like different filmmakers.
Well, it kind of makes sense. It's got a funny, like, origin where it was written by them in the, I think, mid to late 90s, or maybe even a bit earlier than that. And they wrote it as a script that they sold to Universal as essentially just an earner. They had no real, I think they requested like a screenplay, so a hot screenwriters wrote them a screenplay, and then it sort of floated around Universal and no one really picked it up. And it was picked up by Ron Howard's producer, Brian Grazer, and he got hold of it, read it and went, oh, I really like this. This is great. But I guess he was a bit like, it's not really a Ron Howard film, though. So I'll try and find another director and set it up. So it's all kind of ready to go. Everyone's he gets like a star attached, and it's all ready to go. And he needs to find a director for it.
So but hang on. So it's George Clooney and Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yeah.
And Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And they Billy Bob Thornton's barely in it. Really, it's kind of like a cameo almost.
Because I saw this at the cinema. And I think it was followed up by Lady Killers, or it was Lady Killers first and then this, or this then Lady Killers.
Yeah, it sort of seems weird. When I was looking at it, I was trying to, I was sort of surprised I hadn't seen it, but I think perhaps I hadn't seen it because I'd heard it wasn't very good.
It was, but it feels like it was, it doesn't feel like, it feels sort of mainstream. It doesn't feel like a Coen Brothers film in the sense that they take a thriller, but they set it in Minnesota in the snow. The lead is a female cop. She's pregnant and it's a comedy, you know, like where you go, oh, wow. So it's a thriller. It works as sort of like a whodunit thriller mystery, like, you know, Fargo. Not a whodunit, but it works as sort of like this mystery film. But they treat it like it's a comedy, and so it falls somewhere between. Do you know what I mean? Or they've got Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou, which is just sort of like a retelling of Homer's Odyssey, but it's done in like 1920s with bluegrass music. It's kind of like, so the Coen brothers, you know, will take like genres of films that either haven't been done in ages, which was a remake of Sullivan's Travels, wasn't it? Or it was inspired by Sullivan's Travels.
Inspired by, I think it's because the movie he's going to make in that is called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
Right, right. But so they'll take like odd references and they'll kind of like go, oh, how about this? Or like with Hudsucker Proxy, they'll take kind of like a 30s, 40s screwball comedy, and then they'll update it and everyone will go, well, what the fuck is this? You know, it's the year after Jurassic Park. Why are you making films like this anymore? So when Intolerable Cruelty came out, it's like, we're making a George Clooney romantic comedy, but it's called Intolerable Cruelty. I saw it in the cinema and I was like, yeah, it's like, and I know that Lady Killers came out the next year, and then their mum died about that time. And I know that Lady Killers was originally done for Barry Sonnenfeld, who I think was who directed Men in Black and Adam's Family. But I think he was the cinematographer on Barton Fink and Miller's Crossing. And maybe Blood Simple and all the other stuff. But Barry Sonnenfeld was their DOP, and then he went on to be like a director in his own right. So I think they wrote Ladykillers for that, but when their mum died, they were just like, we'll direct it. And I think that there was a little period there where they were kind of like, the way the Coen brothers work is they write five scripts at a time, and then they put them in a drawer, and then they write another load of scripts, and then they take the ones out the drawer, and then they rewrite them. So they've always got like five scripts on the go at any one time. And so it's not like it's good to go. But I know nothing of Intolerable Cruelty. So, Nathaniel, continue.
But very much like you were saying, it's an odd project for them. And I wonder if I would have enjoyed it had I watched it when it came out. Because of those reasons, it's like a very different kind of film for them. But so what happened was, gets hold of it. Brian Grazer, Ron Howard's producer, gets hold of the script. It's not going to be a Ron Howard film. It's not his kind of thing. So they're like looking, he's just going, who can direct it? And he's like, oh, right, well, the answer's right in front of me. I'll ring up the Coen brothers and see if they'll come and direct it. So they call them in for a meeting. They come in for a meeting and say, oh, yeah, we've got this project. And they kind of go, well, we don't really do studio projects. They take the meeting because it's sort of polite. And they go, we're not, you know, we don't really do.
That's what it is, though, isn't it? It's a studio film. Yeah. You know, whereas all of their other films are low, not necessarily low budget, but lower budget indie films, where basically they can be as fucking weird as they're always good. They can be fucking weird, but they're always good. And with Intolerable Cruelty, it's a studio film, so don't be weird.
Yeah.
You know, and so because it's not weird, it's sort of like not really up to their gold standard. I haven't seen it. I haven't wanted to see it since. And I remember not liking it. I'm not enjoying it. Carry on. if this is the first time you're listening to the show, we're not doing it wrong. This is how it works.
This is how it is. And then
it's a clusterfuck.
So we got this. Goes, what is it? And they say, oh, it's well, actually, it's lucky for you. We've got one of your old scripts that we'd like you to do, Intolerable Cruelty. And they're like, ah, oh, bit mainstream, isn't it? Bit mainstream for us. And Brian Grazer is like, you wrote it. How can it be too mainstream? And he goes, it's perfect. And they're like, oh, I don't know. Like, I don't know if it's what we really want to do. We kind of get things set. I'm like the same. It's like, we kind of do things independent. And if you want to do a big studio movie. And they go, well, it's like a go project. Well, you're basically being given a mainstream movie that Ron Howard's producer is like, this is like a hit movie, right? Like, this will give you the kudos to make loads more movies. Why don't you want to make this?
Are the cast already attached?
Well, that's it. It's like, and we've got like, it's like at the time ago, we've got a star attached. So
who was like, the star?
It's the go. And they say, all right, well, who's the star? And they go, Clooney. They go, George Clooney. And they go, oh, we like him. And so it's
just
kind of,
we've literally just worked with him.
Yeah. And they go, oh no, we love George Clooney. And so like Brian Grazer is selling them to try and make this movie, which to him, who makes Ron Howard movies, is like, but why would you not want to make a big hit studio movie that's a go project? But it's because they've got their sensibilities are entirely the opposite, even though what they're making is a film that they wrote. And then it's that that's how they turn around and do it. They go, I guess it is our sensibility because we wrote it. So it's them doing a mainstream kind of romantic comedy. And it feels like it's half kind of regular rom-com and half Coen Brothers film. I found it really satisfying, really enjoyed it. Really funny.
I think that's interesting. I mean, I would have assumed that they would have worked with him on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And then they'd have developed a project specifically for George Clooney. And then they'd have gone, let's just try our hand, like in a quirky kind of way, let's try our hand at doing like what a Coen Brothers mainstream movie would be. But if, yeah, interesting. I do find it, I haven't watched it through those eyes. All I remember is absolute, like, so how did it all work? I probably became first aware of Coen Brothers with Raising Arizona. I think Channel 4 showed it in the early 90s. Maybe it was part of a Nicolas Cage season, including Red Rock West. it's difficult to say, Red Rock West. That's an incredible film.
Great film.
And then I was never really into Barton Fink or Miller's Crossing. So I don't know what else did they make around then before Hudsucker Proxy?
Well, certainly Channel 4 used to show Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink, Raising Arizona.
I like their comedies. I think they're really funny. And I guess all of their films are slightly funny, but Miller's Crossing was always kind of like, oh, it's a... Miller's Crossing... should we talk about the Coen brothers then? So the Coen brothers, they started out... Joel Coen started out as a sound editor. So Joel Coen did the sound editing on Sam Raimi's Evil Dead in 1980, whenever that was made. Have we talked about this before? I was talking to someone about The Shining yesterday, and the poster of The Shining has the poster of Evil Dead has the quote, "the most ferociously original horror movie of the year." And Evil Dead came out the same year as The Shining. And it's kind of like... And I only know it from the Evil Dead point of view, which is it really boosted Evil Dead's popularity at the time. Like, you know, no one was going to go and see this indie horror movie. And then Stephen King endorsed it on their poster with a big poster quote saying, "the most ferociously original horror movie of the year." And then everyone went to see Evil Dead. And it was like... You know, now Sam Raimi's like a top director. But now, 41 years later, he's a top director. But when you look at it in the context, The Evil Dead came out the same year as The Shining. Stephen King hated The Shining. It can only be a public sort of neg at Stanley Kubrick, right? When he goes, "that's The Shining..."
Cost millions to make. He spent a year filming it, or 2 years, 18 months, or whatever it was, filming it. And these guys have basically got $40,000 or something and made a film in like a few weekends.
And Stephen King, "which one are you going to endorse?" And he goes, "Evil Dead." And I hope it blows Stanley Kubrick's The Shining out of the water. I mean, when you look at it, in hindsight, you go, wow, that's crazy. So when they did... Blood Simple, if you watch Blood Simple, that is the Coen brothers' first film, and that's kind of like a thriller. But again, it's got these funny moments in it. But it's a thriller that is shot almost, you know, very much the same way as Evil Dead, where they have like loads of handheld stuff and the camera's really low. There's a bit when he's on his front lawn, isn't there? And then the camera's really low and it speeds across the front lawn towards the guy. And there's a bit, it's just some really funny moments in it. Before Evil Dead 2, but that are very much Sam Raimi inspired. Sam Raimi feels like the lesser cousin of the Coen brothers. But at the time he was, Sam Raimi always aspired to be mainstream. He was a big Three Stooges fan, and him and Bruce Campbell and Rob Tappert, they all wanted to basically make live-action Three Stooges movies. And they, the way that they funded Evil Dead was they went around loads of dentists and they did like a chart of what was popular in cinemas and drive-in movie theatres. And they went like, well, horror is big, so even though our sensibilities are in comedy, let's make a horror movie. And we'll get investors and then we'll get all of their money back because we can just sell this horror movie. And then they made Evil Dead because statistically horror films were kind of like, you know, you could make them cheap and you could make loads of money back. But Sam Raimi always aspired to be kind of like the guy that's making these big budget sort of like screwball-y 1950s inspired sort of like Spider-Man movies. And that's what he went on to do. There's Coen brothers... sort of like learned how to make films off of Sam Raimi. And when you look at the first few, Raising Arizona, exactly, it's like a screwball comedy, very broad, but it's filmed as if it's an Evil Dead film where the camera's like all over the place. And then they sort of grew up a bit and they made Barton Fink. I think I'm getting this right. They did Barton Fink, then they did Miller's Crossing, and then I feel like I'm missing one out.
So do I. Raising Arizona, Barton Fink, Miller's Cross. No, maybe you're right. Maybe that is it.
And then it's Hudsucker Proxy. Hudsucker Proxy was this huge budget 1950s screwball comedy starring Paul Newman, Tim Robbins, who was coming straight off of Bob Roberts, and he was like the big guy in town.
And Jennifer Jason Leigh.
It was produced by Joel Silver, who'd just come off like the Lethal Weapons and the Die Hards. He was like this guy that made these like Demolition Man, Wham! Hudsucker Proxy was 94, was it? And Demolition Man was 93. Joel Silver was making these huge mega budget Mel Gibson, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Seagal, Van Damme. That's what he made. And he made like this romantic screwball comedy Coen Brothers movie. And I think it's not hands down by far, but like by a nose, I think it's their best film. It's certainly my favourite. I eke it out over the years because I don't overwatch it, but I love it. It's great for evenings, wet Sunday afternoons. I love Hudsucker.
I watched it over Christmas this year, and it's a kind of Christmassy film, so all set throughout December.
And it leads up to New Year, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's a good sort of very sort of feel good. It's a good sort of film to watch around that time anyway. It's got all the kind of nice moments like that.
But it's sort of like magical. It's not magical realism, is it? But it's like a fairy tale. And it's almost within the same. It's in the same bracket as something like Edward Scissorhands.
Yes.
Where it's like kind of like. Yeah. It's absolutely it's beautiful. It's funny. It's
probably got something as well of the like very Frank Capra It's a Wonderful Life in that way, where you have like a sort of magic element put into what's essentially quite a serious.
It's got angels in it. It's about heaven and hell fighting over like a little bit that comes into it later on. It's like heaven and hell fighting over the soul of a man. It's like it's absolutely Frank Capra. It's absolutely James Stewart. It makes my heart sore in a way that a lot of the other Coen Brothers films, like Big Lebowski, one of the funniest films I've ever seen, but doesn't fill me with emotions. I laugh and then it's over and I go, I like that. And I can watch that over and over again, but it doesn't affect me emotionally. Whereas, you know, you come out of Hudsucker Proxy and you feel like you're a better person for watching it, you know. We've got to listen to a song, but then we'll pick this back up, right? We're up to Hudsucker Proxy.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. Are we back? We're back. So we were talking about Hudsucker Proxy. The thing about Hudsucker Proxy was it was written by Coen Brothers and Sam Raimi. Mm-hmm. So Sam Raimi's film, he made Evil Dead, and then after Evil Dead, he cashed in his popularity chips. They said, what do you want to make? And he said, I want to make a 1950s screwball comedy called Crime Wave. And they made this film called Crime Wave, and that was written by the Coen Brothers. So I don't know what year that was, but I think it was either after Blood Simple, but before they... It was kind of... I think it came out in 1984...
85.
85 was Crime Wave, and Evil Dead 2 was 86. So the reason Evil Dead 2 came about was because Evil Dead was such a huge mega hit, and Sam Raimi was like, I can do anything. And so he made Crime Wave, which is awful. There are some bits in it that are amazing. We've talked about this before, I'm sure. There are some bits in it that are amazing, but as a whole film, it really is an annoying film. And then it was such a bad, massive flop that Sam Raimi was forced to make Evil Dead 2. But when he made Evil Dead 2, he was just like, I want to make comedies. So he made Evil Dead 2 basically a comedy. So Crime Wave was set... the prison in Crime Wave is called Hudsucker Institute, I think. It's definitely Hudsucker. And... I'm just watching the notes get filled in one by one, and it's really distracting. So Crime Wave was written by it's a Sam Raimi film, but it was written by the Coen Brothers and Sam Raimi. Because they sort of like owned this idea, I think they had like this shared universe idea of like this place called Hudsucker. So when they had this script for the Hudsucker Proxy, which is, I guess, a Coen Brothers sort of screwball comedy, not a Sam Raimi screwball comedy. So I guess maybe if they'd have swapped projects, Crime Wave might have come across as more of a Coen Brothers. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like who directed what. I think that they all wrote both of the films. Yeah. And on the one hand, you've got this very classic feeling. I mean, it feels like it could have been made in the 50s. It's that it doesn't. It's obviously very modern, and they use modern techniques. But in terms of its heart, it feels like very much like a 50s film. Whereas Crime Wave feels like a 90, like an 80s movie. It feels like. I mean, I think that Sam Raimi and the Coen Brothers were obsessed with Looney Tunes cartoons, and I know Nicolas Cage based his whole performance in Raising Arizona on Wile E. Coyote.
Right, makes a lot.
He was like that. He goes, that look that he gives the camera just before he falls off the cliff is kind of like what he based his entire performance on, right? And you go, oh, yeah, I can see that. So they had this sort of shared universe. The thing, right, I'm not going to get there yet, but then they made... Hudsucker Proxy was a massive flop. I think it's because it was their biggest budget and it was Joel Silver and they were expecting huge things. But it was, I think it was Universal, and it was like this big flop. And so they went back to doing.
Fargo.
So where's this list? So they did. Have you gone backwards or what? I mean, this is just a random list of films.
No, it's Fargo next, isn't it? Fargo after Hudsucker Proxy.
I see. Fargo, Big Lebowski. Yes. Yeah, so Hudsucker Proxy. Yeah, but so going back, Nat, to Lee, was there something in between Barton Fink, Miller's Crossing and Fargo? I mean, this is literally, this is what people come to the show for, Malta. It's two guys refusing to personally use IMDb, but then getting their producer to look stuff up to fact check them live on it. It's just people, it's just two guys remembering things that they've definitely covered in an earlier episode.
Okay, we got it. Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink. Oh, no, that's it.
Was it that way round? That's interesting. Right, okay. I would have definitely thought it was Barton Fink and then Miller's Crossing.
I guess Raising Arizona is the more... Yeah, I would. But I guess Raising Arizona is the one you think of being like a proper funny, funny comedy followed by serious.
Yeah.
Followed by...
Well, what's Barton Fink?
I think it's a not comedy. Comedy. It's sort of like...
Last time I saw it, which must have been about 10 years ago, it felt like very much like a drama with this bonkers ending. And you kind of like go, okay, sure. Miller's Crossing has a cameo from Sam Raimi. Hudsucker Proxy has a cameo from Sam Raimi. But we're not getting into the juicy bit yet. And then you got Fargo. So Hudsucker Proxy was their biggest flop. Then they did Fargo. Then they did Big Lebowski. Great. That, I don't think it got critically well received. But
not when it came out, because Man. Everyone loved Fargo so much, was such a kind of... Got yeah. Oscars and got, you know...
So they made Fargo, and then Sam Raimi made A Simple Plan, which was... It was kind of like a less quirky, non-funny, straight... It was based on a book as well, but it was kind of like Sam Raimi's... I mean, they're not... I don't feel like they're in competition. I feel like they are very much like... what do you call it? Like a group of actors. They're like a troupe.
Yeah. Well, they came up together, don't they? So they're obviously all friends, and I guess they're... If they're at all kind of in competition, it's a sort of friendly competition. It's more like kind of, we're doing... You know, I guess it's just exciting for them to be pals who are both... making movies at the same time and coming up together.
Yeah, because like Frances McDormand, who went on to do Fargo, was the lead actress in Darkman. Mm. And that's where it ends. But I'm trying to think, what was Holly Hunter in? Holly Hunter was in Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
So they've kind of like, and I think Holly Hunter was originally meant to be the Bob, is it Bubba Joe in Evil Dead 2?
Oh, really?
And for some reason, and not because she's too good, but for some reason she didn't do Evil Dead 2. But like, they were like sharing the same cast at the time. So yeah, there's kind of like this big... crossover thing. So didn't see The Naked Man. That is the film that was directed by Ethan Coen specifically.
I can't remember that.
And I think it starred Michael Rapaport as a guy with tattoos all over him and he became a wrestler. I remember the Naked Man is a 1998 comedy film produced by Naked Man Productions, directed by J. Todd Anderson, and co-written by Anderson and Ethan Coen. Right, okay, so he didn't direct it. And who's it starred? Does it star Michael Rapaport? The front cover of it, I think, was Michael Rapaport covered in tattoos, jumping in a wrestling ring.
It's passed me by.
From what I remember, Michael Rapaport. Not only did it pass you by, but I passed it by in Blockbuster Video. then there was... Then there was Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. Great. Then there was The Man Who Wasn't There.
Yes. Billy Bob Thornton, Black and White.
Yes, UFO? That was... Well, it was sort of like connected to UFO. So, right, okay. So The Man Who Wasn't There, that, to me, was the disappointing... The Big Lebowski. That was when it was just kind of like, I love these guys. What's next? And then The Man Who Wasn't There was kind of like, oh, what's this? And I never really connected with that. So
I guess what it's trying to do is a sort of genre mashup that's doing a sort of 50s noir film with a 50s B-movie flying saucer movie.
The flying saucer stuff is kind of like... it's sort of like, it's just lip service though, isn't it? It's kind of aesthetically they're using it and it's like they're nodding towards it, but it's not really anything to do with flying saucers. It doesn't really, you could cut that out and it wouldn't affect the plot. It's not, they don't go, oh my God, there's flying saucers that are, and then it turns out to be something else. It's like literally they just use imagery, don't they?
I think you're right.
I feel like it's kind of, it's just like an aesthetic thing, and you're kind of like, superficial. Billy Bob Thornton was great in it. I just don't remember. I mean, I completely forgot about it. And then you get Intolerable Cruelty, Lady Killers, Parish of Ten. They were going through like a weird phase.
Mm. And perhaps even after Man Who Wasn't There, which is probably a risky black and white movie, which I suspect didn't make a lot of money.
I think it did win the Oscars though, right?
Oh, did it? Maybe so.
Maybe it didn't win loads, but I think by that point they were kind of like...
darlings.
I think Man Who Wasn't There, yeah, they were darlings. After Fargo, Big Lebowski was kind of like, what the fuck is this? And then with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, again, they were just like, yeah, we love you again. And they reinvented George Clooney, basically, after Batman and Robin.
Mm.
And he'd done Three Kings by then, but... or maybe it was around the same time, maybe it was just after, but like, so he was kind of like reinventing himself from ER.
And also being shown he could do, like, he was really good at comedy, and he could do that kind of sort of square-jawed sort of hero, but who's also, you know, in the Bruce Campbell mould, almost, he could do square-jawed hero who's also sort of funny, a bit slapstick.
It's a miracle that George Clooney now exists, because he did. He was in a Return of the Killer Tomatoes, ER, and then from ER, he did From Dusk Till Dawn. Then he was Batman in the film that basically ended everyone's careers, including Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, he never really had like a proper legitimate hit after that, and then except for Terminator 3, and then he worked with the Coen brothers, and that was kind of like the regeneration of who he was as a movie star now. So then you get Lady Killers, Parish of Ten, No Country for Old Men, great film, Burn After Reading, minor. I mean, I don't love it.
No.
I would lump that in with Intolerable Cruelty and Lady Killers, really. Serious Man.
Watch that again this week. It's a lot of fun, actually. I think it was one of those things where I can't remember whether I was reluctant to see it because it was like, there's no famous people in it. But it is. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun when you watch it.
I think it's really good. It's one of those films that's sort of like set in a day, isn't it?
No, it isn't. No, it's set over probably a week or so, I think. It's set over two weeks, in fact.
Right, so it's got like this... but that's part of the plot, isn't it? It's about a guy that's having a really bad sort of fortnight, and then...
Yeah.
And I always find those films sort of, like, diverting, but, like... I don't always find those films diverting, but they don't feel sort of... not that a film has to be epic, but you know what I mean? They feel almost like disposable. It's like you go, oh, Martin Scorsese, he did Goodfellas, and then he also did After Hours. And After Hours just feels like a different filmmaker, and it's kind of like completely disposable. You go, yeah, it's interesting in a kind of like, he also made this film kind of way, but it's not one of his classics, you know?
I like After Hours, but I know what
people
you mean.
I know people love After Hours. It's set in one night. The whole thing happens, you know, he leaves work and then he goes back to work in the morning, kind of. No spoilers. Watch After Hours. Write in to tell us what you thought about it. I'm looking forward to... I've never seen Last Temptation of Christ, so I'm going to watch that over Easter. Brilliant. going to have a Jesus triple bill. Going to watch Last Temptation of Christ and Passion of the Christ.
And if never seen that.
No,
I watched Last Temptation of Christ last Easter, and then it sort of went. I like it, but it's one of those films. Like, I don't know why I'm really watching this. What I actually want to watch is like a bank holiday movie. But it feels like
Ben Hur or Ten Commandments or something.
No, like what I think is like the Bible. Job is a bank holiday movie. You want to watch something fun. Because it's like feels like it's sort of like a public holiday.
It's Last Temptation of Christ, not fun.
It's not fun, no.
Oh fuck sticks! Oh, I was expecting it to be a real romp. I was expecting Harvey Keitel as Judas to get his knob out.
I won't spoil the ending, but something happens to Jesus at the end and it's a bit depressing.
Oh, no. That's all I need. Not at Easter. He doesn't gorge himself on chocolate eggs and get no. fat, does he?
It really isn't the spirit of Easter at all.
Okay, right. Anyway, so the thing about that I always find really interesting, to wrap this up. So then, Serious Man, True Grit, sure. Gambit, what? I couldn't even remember that they made Gambit.
I remember that.
Isn't Gambit the one with... I get Gambit and Mordecai mixed up, but isn't Gambit the one with Alan Rickman, Hugh Grant... No, not Hugh Grant, Colin Firth.
Is it Cameron Diaz?
Cameron Diaz? Who's the star of Gambit?
Here we go.
Uma Thurman.
No, not seen that.
Oh, and then they did Hail Caesar as well, which is kind of like... who's the guy? Alden Ehrenreich is brilliant in it. And then you go, he's going to be Han Solo. And you go, great. Let him. He doesn't know anything like... It was Cameron Diaz. It's like Alden Ehrenreich. He doesn't know anything like Harrison Ford, but by all means, let him play Han Solo. He's great. He does this really cool thing on a horse. You remember. Gambit, starring Stanley Tucci.
Oh, yeah.
Tucci? If you get his name wrong...
if you say his name five times, it turns out...
If you get his name wrong, he gets very Tucci about it. That's just how I say it. That's just how I say it, Matt. Tucci. His name is Tucci. I've got a high five. So the thing about Coen Brothers and Sam Raimi is that Bruce Campbell is, if you put Bruce Campbell as your lead actor, it might not be a successful film, but it will be a cult classic to some degree. People will watch it just because of Bruce Campbell. And I think maybe, if you put Bruce Campbell as a cameo in your film, it will be box office poison. So, Crime Wave, Bruce Campbell was meant to be the lead, but he ended up being a cameo or a lesser part, and it suffered the consequence. He would have been a great lead in Crime Wave, but it didn't happen. He had a cameo in Hudsucker Proxy. Again, they suffered the consequence, and it was a Paul Newman movie. Produced by Joel Silver, directed by the Coen Brothers. A massive flop. He has a cameo in Intolerable Cruelty. Is he a dog trainer in Intolerable Cruelty?
No, he's a soap actor.
He's a soap actor in Intolerable Cruelty, and he's a dog trainer in Lady Killers.
That's right.
Back to back, Bruce Campbell. As a kid at university growing up, who lived off IMDb, and went on Bruce Campbell's IMDb page every day to find out he was making not only two movies with the Coen Brothers, but also From Dusk Till Dawn 2. I was over the moon. And then to see those final films, I was just like, oh, what the fuck is this? Put him in it! Bruce, like before Ash vs. Evil Dead came out, the Coen Brothers went on record to say that they have read a script for Sam Raimi's Evil Dead 4. And it's about Bruce Campbell fighting deadites at a petrol station. And they said it's one of the best scripts they'd ever read. And it never got made. And the Coen Brothers are fans. Quentin Tarantino's a fan. Robert Rodriguez is a fan. You've got all of these indie makers, filmmakers, that are making low-budget films. Just put Bruce Campbell as the lead in one of your films. Give him a chance. And then it was left up to Don Coscarelli to make him the lead in Bubba Hotep, which was an Oscar-worthy performance. Oh, I've gone off on one again now. The only one out of those that features Bruce Campbell that did very well was Fargo. And they use a old video clip of him in a soap opera on a TV while William H. Macy's wife is tied up to a chair with a bag over her head. And on the TV is Bruce Campbell. But he didn't turn up for work. They just used an old clip of him from a TV show. So there you go. That's... Again, another lovely chat that we've had, Nat, ruined by me losing my temper at the injustice of Bruce Campbell's career. We've got time for some fan mail, then we'll play a song and then we'll bring our wonderful guest on. All right, so, podcast 68 in Malta, 203 in Estonia! Come on, Estonia! 203, tell your fucking friends. Someone has written, Fan Dabby, 5 stars. That doesn't...
This is an iTunes review.
That's an iTunes review, but that isn't equated, that isn't like allocated to anyone. That's just, it just says...
No, squirty slart fart.
No, but that's, it says Fan Dabby, 5 stars, and then it's got the quote, and then it's got... So maybe that's what, the title of the review, and then the review, and then... Yeah. Is that what it is? Squirty slart fart says, so exciting, it made me do a poo.
Oh, great. Lovely.
With fans like you. Dear Nick and Nathaniel, trust you are both well. I enjoy your show every week. I noticed the documentary Drew, the man behind the poster, about the legendary poster artist Drew Struzan, is on Sky at the moment. I think his work is great. A few questions, if you don't mind. I've seen that documentary. I actually bought it on DVD, and I am furious. I've seen that documentary. It's a great documentary. I love Drew Struzan, obviously. If you don't know who Drew Struzan is, Google him. He did some, if not all, of the very best Police Academy posters you grew up with. What are your favourite movie posters? Police Academy 3, 4 and then 5. Do you prefer UK Quad or one sheet poster format? How about you, Nat? What's your favourite movie poster?
Ones that spring to mind are things like Alien. I find that really great poster.
With the egg?
Just the big egg.
But it's weird, isn't it? Because the egg is cracking.
Hmm.
And there's light coming out of it, but that's not how they work in the movie.
No. No, exactly.
Exactly. What do you mean exactly? You haven't answered anything there. You haven't made anything clearer.
But I like that. That's the first thing that springs to mind. But I was thinking about that yesterday. Instead, it has a crack with like a green ooze coming out of it. So it's not typical of what would happen in the movie, but it still gives you that idea. And it's still one that feels appropriate. It doesn't feel like people have gone in and changed it afterwards. It still feels like they've gone, that's it. That's the poster for Alien.
I agree, but Alien has got such like a history with design. You know, they got H.R. Giger. Did they get Mobius, or did they get someone that...
I think so he was involved HR, as well, yeah.
H.R. Giger did all of the Alien effects. Not just the alien, but the alien world and the alien spaceship and everything like that. So they got H.R. Giger to do all of that. And separately, they got another guy who did sort of like... I think he did like Heavy Metal magazine and all of that. He did all of like the terrestrial human design, and then when you combine the two different design elements, it looks like they're from different planets because it's from two different brains. You know, that is genius. But then when it came to the marketing, someone said, well, these aliens, they come out of an egg. And so someone has literally drawn like a green egg and put a crack in it. Like it's...
Well, I guess Drew Struzan's The Thing poster's kind of like that, isn't it? It's just like a, you know...
Got it on my wall up here.
Huge light coming out of a face. But it's not something that relates to anything in the movie. But it gives you this sort of impression of something that's like... It still feels like the perfect poster for it. And yet it's not something that feels like it's...
You don't know who it is, The Thing. John Carpenter's The Thing. You don't know who it is. On the poster, it's just someone wearing a parka anorak, but there's a light emitting from its face, and it's basically sums up everything that you need to know from the film without showing you any details from the film, other than the fact that it's snow and someone's wearing a parka coat, and it encapsulates the film without giving you any details from the film. Mm. It's great. I would say, also on top of that, we don't have time for any more, but on top of that, I would say the Back to the Future one is absolutely timeless.
I think so as well, yeah. And the way it's sort of adapted for the other two is always quite satisfying as well.
I really enjoyed the fact that they just added another person on for each of them. Really satisfying. But also, again, it doesn't really give you It's not like a photo from something that happens in the film. It's literally, this is your film, this is your poster. It's like a classic poster. It's just like, there's your main guy, there's the vehicle, there's fire on the ground. It's like, I love the colours. If you've got like 50 quid or 20 quid, or I don't know how much the books are, but just get yourself a Drews and art book, and you can spend hours just pouring through it. He did, like, later on he did the Harry Potter stuff, and then everything got photoshopped. When by the time Marvel came along, everyone sort of like photoshopped it, but there is sort of like a movement. Every so often you get someone that's done sort of like a Drews-esque poster. But people have lost the skill, and then the drawn posters aren't ever as good as they used to be. Anyway, let's play a song and get our guest on.
She was a lipstick boy, she was a beautiful boy.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're back live in the studio. We're not live, it's pre-recorded, and we're not in the studio. I'm in my spare room, Nat's in his washroom, and we're joined now by one of my favourite comedians, Zoe Lyons. Hello, Zoe, how you doing?
Hi. I'm good, how are you? You all right?
I'm fine. Today I'm fine. Somebody told me in the week that they were, this hasn't ever occurred to me before, somebody told me in the week that they were an introverted extrovert.
Oh, yes, I'm aware of that combo.
Or an extroverted introvert, and I've never thought about that. I know that I have therapy, and a lot of the days I can't get out of bed because I am so washed over by bleakness and depression, and then I'll sit down and talk to my therapist. But just because I'm talking to someone, I feel great. And I'm just to be honest, I can't remember why I booked this appointment.
I've just got myself a therapist. I live in Brighton. I think I'm the last one to do it. And it's quite interesting. As a comedian with a therapist, I really am playing it for laughs. And I'm very aware of that. I'm very aware of that. But I think, well, sod it, I'm paying for it. She can damn well laugh.
Yeah, and also I think that might be what therapy you need at the minute, because you've not got an audience anymore. You've got everyone sat at home, they've not got anyone to perform to. I have a therapist, and occasionally I say something funny, and I know it's funny, and he does a sort of the slightest kind of half acknowledgement.
Why are you using humour in this situation? You're like, because I'm a comedian.
I have been consistently unfunny. And gradually I've sort of broken her down over however long I've been seeing her. And so now I'll sort of say a joke and I'll look and I'll be maybe I think it's come to the fact that maybe Belinda's not my target audience. So you just have to accept the fact that not everyone's going to like you.
Yeah.
it'd be terrible if you went online afterwards and you found out she'd been reviewing you.
It was a Zoom gig that you didn't realise.
Okay, so Zoe, we've known each other for a very long time. Am I remembering this incorrectly? But were you doing a show at the Pleasance Beside? Did you ever do a show at the Pleasance Beside in the courtyard? Or am I remembering
this? Yes. Yes, I think it was the Beside. It was a porter cabin that was very expensive.
It was the one that looked like what's the place? The Palace of Solitude in Superman.
I don't remember.
Fortress.
I'm getting that feeling from it. Is that like an 80-seater? Is that what we're looking at here? Yeah.
I think I did it after you did it, so not directly after you, but years later. I think it was I did mine in 2011, and it was the Fortress of Solitude, where they had sort of it was a porter cabin, but on the outside they'd built it to be kind of this very sort of white spiky structure. And then years later
I remember.
That was a nice venue, wasn't it?
It was a nice venue.
What show were you doing there?
I can't remember which one it was. It would have been some ill thought out 60 minutes worth of rambling nonsense. It could have been clown busting, that classic. Oh gosh. Yeah.
You did a show called Clown Busting?
Clown Busting. Yeah. Yeah. I have no idea where that came from. I have no idea what that show was about. And what else did I do in that? I did another one. I did a show called Miss Machismo.
When did you do your first Edinburgh?
I think it was 2004, I think. Yeah, about then.
Your first solo show, 2004.
Yeah, 2004, in the cellar in the Pleasance. It was a brutal experience. I got such small audiences. Every night I'd come out of my venue, I'd come up the steps, and, after waiting for the three or four people to leave, And then I would, by coming out of the steps and leaving my little room, I would find myself every night at the end of Simon Amstel's queue that was going full four squares, like, round the courtyard. And it was just, it was such a trying time. Yeah, a very trying time. That's that first year when the tech goes, I'm going to open the doors and let them in. You go, okay. And then you hear, like, two sets of feet. And then they go, they're in. And you're like, oh, my God. I nearly tried to fake an angina attack to get off stage.
randomly, because we don't always talk about comedy, but we were talking about this in the first half, weren't we? And I think that those experiences make me so much more grateful. Now, I think that you're not a real comedian unless you've had those gigs.
Yeah, which are very much tainted with shame, embarrassment, horror, also, and fear. There's nothing about comedy for them when you're doing those things. You're not sat behind a curtain hearing those two sets of feet coming in going, I cannot wait to entertain these people. shame is what it is.
I think the thing that's about those sort of situations as well, it's that Edinburgh is a thing where you have reviewers come and you've got people who are coming to see you.
Yeah.
And they see it. But if you're doing it and there's two or three other people in the audience, people go away and go, well, this apparently is the show. But I'm not hearing a lot of light. I'm not hearing a lot here. Not much atmosphere in this room. As if that's your fault then. It's not really the show. What you're experiencing, this isn't what it's meant to be like.
Oh, gosh. It's such a weird thing, isn't it? It's such a strange thing. Doing comedy in places or in environments where it just...
I not like being defensive or anything, but I also think that comedy is one of those things where it's almost like, maybe it's the standard of gigs that I've had, but it's almost like you can't review it unless it's a DVD or a recorded performance, and then you can go, well, that's what I think of this recorded performance. Even like a tour show, it's just kind of like, I did my last tour, I just remembered one of the best gigs which I recorded, which I'm streaming in next month. I'm plugging something. The third from last gig was at Leicester Square Theatre, and it was great, right? It was nice, big audience. The show was as good as it's ever going to be. Right. The next gig was a week later, and I've toured it. I've done it like 70 times by this point. I've done the tour, first half of the tour. The next week, I had to do two more gigs. I did Southampton, where there were drunk people. And it was not late. I had to put the seats out myself or rearrange the seats because it was a music venue. And I was just like, you can't do this. And they were literally watching me move the seats and said, we've never seen an act move the seats before. And I was like, well, you can't do it. There was like, it was like 120 seats or something like that. It wasn't huge, but there was like a 15-foot mosh pit that they'd put in. And it's like, no, they've got to be close to the... So I moved it all. There was drunk people. I had to redo the first 20 minutes of the second half of the show because drunk people disrupted it, so I had to redo it. And then the week after that, there was a couple of people that do lots of charity work that come to see loads of gigs, and they live in Exeter, and they were like, please come to Exeter. Exeter wasn't on the list, so I made them add Exeter onto the list. And when I got there, it was on a rainy Friday night. The venue was half full at most, and the couple that wanted me to do it had diarrhea that night, and so they weren't even there, right? And you go, this is my proudest moment. This is the best show I've ever written, and you know, it was a great tour, but the last three gigs were so wildly different from each other that you go, how do you review live comedy?
How do you gauge what that is? Yeah,
it's very good of you to do a show based on the idea that two people in Exeter want to see it and go, well, I'll put on a gig there then.
Quite needy, Nick.
I'm a people person. I'd do anything for them cunts. So it was great. But so I think those experiences that you never sort of get rid of are the things that make you a comedian.
Yeah.
Especially those. Do you miss the fact? Would you have done Edinburgh this year had it gone ahead? Or
No. No, for many reasons. I've had quite an intense lockdown and various. This wouldn't have been the year to make myself any more vulnerable, because Edinburgh is a bit like. You're all right when you're in your venue, but out of your venue, you're very much like a hermit crab that's left its shell behind, and you just sort of scurry around waiting not to be eaten by something for a whole month. It's just...
Yeah.
So, no, I wouldn't have gone this year. I may go again, but I may not. I mean, I don't know. I just got offered a gig in Tottenham. And my first thought was, that's miles away. I'm not doing that anymore.
I think
if I got a gig within sort of 5 miles, it probably won't be happening anymore.
Unless it was a tour, if I was getting a tour together or a new show together, like for previews,
yeah,
I would aim for my previews to be London,
yeah,
and smaller than that, North London, and smaller than that, I will book six gigs at Pleasance Islington, and then that is. And if I can walk there, but I'm not going to go up to Nottingham and die on my ass with new material and then come back again. It's all got to be local.
Yeah.
And then if it's a tour, I've got a guy that drives me on tour who picks me up, forces me into the van, and then takes me to the tour and forces me on. You know, it's like.
It's that's one good. Of those
things. And also with Edinburgh, having all that. I was thinking about this yesterday, just like. I would do another. I would obviously love to write another show, but I'm just thinking. But I don't want to go to Brooks Bar. Do you know what I mean? It's like I don't want the nightlife.
No.
And I don't want like the hanging around with. My favourite Edinburgh was the last Edinburgh we did, and it was because I did a show in the afternoon and another show in the evening. And
yeah,
the show in the afternoon was my solo show, and the evening show was a musical I did. And so I'd get to do it with other people. And I didn't have any downtime. It was always getting ready for the next show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's better almost, isn't it?
I loved it. But like you say, when you don't have... When you got your show done, it's just like, what the fuck am I meant to do now?
Yeah.
Walk 15 miles back to my rented accommodation. You're stranded, aren't you?
And then you always want to go and see lots, and then you're actually not in the mood to see anything, because if you've had a bad show, you don't want to go and see a good show. You know what I mean? You're always just in the wrong place at the wrong time. You're always sort of 5 minutes either side of yourself. It's just a very strange month. I did 2 weeks. When did I go last time? Not last year, but the year before I did 2 weeks, and that was perfect. I really enjoyed that. That was really nice. 2 weeks seemed fine. When you go for a month, I can't help thinking, it's a 12th of a year. That feels like a long time.
And also, when you... I don't know why my thing is alerted like that. when you do several years, you know, I get to the point where it's like, I've spent a year and a half in Edinburgh without ever living there properly. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like...
Yeah.
I spent more time living in Edinburgh than I have in Brighton, and I lived in Brighton.
Yeah, yeah. A year in Edinburgh, yeah, it would have been, yeah, it wouldn't for me, not that many shows.
But so we just recently did stand up and deliver. on Channel 4 for Stand Up to Cancer, and I didn't really know the lineup going into it, and then it kind of like. And then I looked at very late on. I looked at the list on who was doing it, and I don't. Really know any of didn't know any of the others kind of like going in. I sort of knew Jason Manford I think he'd been a guest on the show actually during lockdown, but I didn't know him. But I knew you, and I just remember the first day I was very, because we hadn't left our houses.
No,
it was November we filmed, or maybe late October. We hadn't left our houses in a year. And I was so nervous about doing it, and I'd forgotten how to do comedy. So I was like, who am I to teach people how to do comedy? And you were the first person that walked in when I was there. And I was so relieved to see you. You made me feel so much better about doing it.
You were like, how appalling she looks.
No, the opposite. I was so happy to be doing it with you. So how did you find it, and how did it all come about?
I found it very tricky. I found it very tricky. Because like you, I hadn't gigged for ages and ages and ages. And I felt, my overall feeling, as most comics have most of the time, was one of massive fraud being committed by me trying to teach somebody else to be a comedian when I'd felt so isolated from it, yeah, for want of a better word, for ages. So it was actually quite hard. I found it quite hard, and it wasn't the being seen as a mentor or being seen as a teacher. It was not being seen as a fraud. That was the thing that I really struggled with. But I enjoyed it in the end. I did enjoy it in the end, and I thought they did well. I mean, you're the Baroness. Come on. God, she was brilliant.
I think, yeah, I've said this several times. I think that she would have done... I don't know if she'd have won, but I think that she was already at a level where she would have done well no matter what.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's a little bit fraudulent to be able to say, we won. I feel like, she won.
No. You
and I was there going...
I think you were beautiful condiments together. You really were. You were... It was lovely. Really lovely.
But when we did the very, because the way it works is we met on the first day, we didn't see each other for 2 weeks, and then we had to do the final night. And it was really, I was so nervous on that last night. You had to compare, and I was just like, thank fuck they haven't asked me. Because on the day, they basically, on the last day, we were all in our dressing rooms with our, what do you call them, protégés. And they kind of like casually, the TV company, they casually kind of like say, oh yeah, so you got to go on stage and say some, just say some, a couple of funny things. And then, and you're like, what?
What? I know.
I haven't said a couple of funny things in 10 months. What are you talking about? And this isn't a gig. This is being filmed for TV. I don't want to fucking go on stage and say a couple of fucking funny things. That, you know, they're the one that spent 2 weeks writing material. I haven't written any fucking material. And then they said to you, you've got to go up and compare a section.
Yeah,
and I was just like, fuck it, it's not me. You went on and you absolutely fucking smashed it. That was it was incredible.
But it's an awful feeling. I know what you mean, though, when you're like, what? Do what? Yeah. Yeah, I have not been very productive during lockdown. I haven't written very much at all. So it is weird when you are asked to just sort of go on the spot like that. I think people just assume that you're constantly churning it out.
I was going to say that. Do you think that's TV people going, go on, do some of your comedy now?
Do some of your comedy now.
But it's like you're always doing it, and all they need to do is shuffle you in front of a microphone, and then they go, like, they've done 5 minutes, and then they shuffle you off, and then you're still doing it in the corner of the room.
It's not busking, it's just it's like you're more involved. People always assume it. I remember once, I turned down a corporate gig because I did the right thing and asked the right questions. And I said, so how are you doing this? I went, right, well, what we've got, right, we just thought it'd be like a fun day out for everybody, so we're having like lots of different things. So people will just be wandering in and out, and like on one plinth we'll have like a musician, and then on another plinth we'll have, and I went, oh, God, no. No, there'll be no wandering in and out on a plinth. This all, no, that will not work. I did a festival once in Rotterdam. Did you ever do the Rotterdam Comedy Festival?
No.
It was great fun. Rotterdam's an amazing city. But again, they did it like that. They were like, okay, sure, people will just buy tickets for the whole show, and then they're going to just wander in and out. And I was like, oh, God, that's so not well thought through. Oh, it was, tricky.
I just remembered I got asked to do a wedding where it was me and my guitarist, and we were going to be in a field, and there was going to be kind of like old-fashioned sort of like games like billiards over there in one corner of the field, and over there it would be like me singing songs with the guitarist, and you know, there'll be sort of like finger nibble, you know, a finger buffet over it. And then I've just remembered it was my sister's wedding. I think I'll turn that down. Yeah, but it's one of the things that I was sort of like a bit apprehensive about doing the show was giving someone all of my tricks and putting that on or to expose yourself for how few tricks you actually have.
Oh yeah, that was my problem. Yeah.
But then also it was kind of like showing the general public how easy stand-up is. But I think in actual fact, the opposite occurred, and it was like, oh, actually, I've never thought about my process before like this, in a way that you've got to teach it. It's second nature to, I've got to do a show, I'll go through the same things. But in terms of teaching it to someone else, I'd never really thought about it like that. Yeah. And then when you realise actually it is quite a difficult thing. I mean, I don't know.
I think you can learn certain aspects of it, but I think you can either do it or you can't. And I know there's lots of classes you can do in stand-up comedy. And there's courses.
It's a university degree.
University degree. But you can either, it's either in you or it's not, isn't it? I think bits and pieces you can learn, but to be a performer, to be a stand-up, I think it's got to be slightly innate.
I thought it's a really interesting show to watch, and I think it's one of the better examples of, even though it felt like a Channel 4 show that was edited to show certain things and not others, I thought it showed what stand-up was and wasn't quite well.
Okay.
It's this sort of, this isn't it. This is close to it, but it's not quite it. And this is it. And I thought you had Katie McGlynn, and I remember on it you were saying, you're quite a funny person, and she was denying it. She wouldn't have it.
Yeah.
Where it's just that, but in her own speaking, just in normal telling a story or chatting, I could feel that. I was thinking, you're quite funny. That's quite funny what you just said.
Yeah.
But she couldn't. Because she could never accept herself as being a funny person. It was obviously harder for her to project it.
Yeah. And it's also. Hanging on to
the bits
of you that are, funny.
But going from what you said, Zoe, you can sort of like, all of these little stages of kind of like where you maybe not everyone can do it. But, and when you get to the final hurdle, it's kind of like, do you enjoy it? You might be able to do it, but do you actually like standing up on stage in the first place? You know, and if you don't, then you shouldn't. Do you know what I mean? It's like when I did my first gig, I was shit, but I enjoyed being on stage trying.
Yeah.
And that's what kept me going at first, was like, oh, how I can get on stage, so how can I do it? But if you can do it, but you can't get up on stage, then that's kind of just as debilitating.
Yeah. I mean, I still get nervous getting on stage. I still get very nervous.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. Properly nervous, real questioningly nervous, like, why on earth am I doing this? In fact, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and I'm probably overly sensitive to be... There's many factors that are going against me. I'm overly sensitive, and I don't like late nights, so I'm really not cut out for this at all.
I think it goes against your... self-preservation, doesn't it? It's almost the maddest thing you could do.
Yeah.
Is to go out there, especially if you're not someone who has a massive sort of self-belief or something. It's almost like testing this thing which could unravel you at every opportunity. It'd be like, well, don't do that. And no one would say, go, yeah, keep doing that. This thing that's sort of trying to show yourself off. But, you know, it's great if you win, but it's like... there's a sort of fragility to it, but unless, I don't know. But like, I think it shows you in a better light for feeling like that than it does if you're super confident. Because you are putting yourself out there in a sort of ridiculous way that people
It would make sense that you should be nervous about that. It's like, I feel nervous. Well, you should be, mate. You really should be. This is knowing you as I know you and the skills you've got, you should be nervous.
I've had bad gigs and they will tear you to fucking shreds, mate. If you are anything other than 110%, you haven't got a fucking chance. And I've been there. fucking hell. I mean, I get incredibly nervous. It used to be when you first start, there were so many comedians in London, but not enough gigs, and so you would, or maybe there were so many gigs, but not enough comedians. There was something where it was potential to gig every night of the week, but in an empty pub.
Yeah.
Or there's not enough audience. That's the one. Yes. There wasn't enough audience. But when I first started out, which was 2006, it was like you could do a gig and you get really nervous for your gig and you do your gig, but then your next gig would be 2 weeks later or a month later, and then anything you'd learnt from that first gig was out the window because you had to put all of your energy into building up enough strength and courage and whatever to just get back on stage again. So the learning curve was so slow so shallow at that point, because it was just about kind of like getting nervous and waiting to go on stage. And now I've got it.
Yes.
Now I've got it. And then it would be like a week. I'd get nervous a week before a gig. And then in Edinburgh, I'd be kind of nervous all of the time. My favourite moment would be the exact moment I got off stage, because it'd be the longest moment. It was the longest I had before I had to get on stage again.
Yes.
And then it would be kind of, and now I think I got, when I was on tour and it was like becoming, it would be like, I get nervous an hour before I get on stage. Mm. And if you would give me, and I say it in my show, but if you'd give me any excuse to not do it, you know, like a snow day, or a global pandemic, it would be like, oh, thank God. But the moment I get on stage, or I forget all of that, and I enjoy it.
Yeah, it's like, it's waiting for the phone to ring, isn't it? So the motorway's been blocked. And you're like, oh, no, what a shame. I really won't find an alternative way to get there. Oh, dear. Yeah.
How do you feel now, Zoe, about the prospect of returning to stand-up? Or have you done gigs within lockdown points? Or?
I've done Zoomy gigs, which at first I was quite resistant to, but then I thought I've got to do something, because otherwise I am just... I mean, I've got to be really honest. When the first lockdown happened, I had a massive panic attack in Co-op in Hove by the yogurts, but then I recovered quite quickly. And then there was a bit of me that was like, I don't have to go anywhere. This is awesome. And then when people started, like, within minutes, the usual characters sort of panicked and went, we have to find another way of performing. And I'm like, we kind of don't for a bit.
Don't ruin it. We got a good thing, guys.
We sort of don't. I mean, there was a bit of me that was like, if I'm going to go through a pandemic, I'd like to experience it properly and not try and just sort of pretend it's not there. I want to have the full impact. And I really have. I mean, I'm living in it. I mean, it's all happened. It's brutal. But I mean, I've lived this pandemic properly. And yeah, my driving force wasn't getting a Zoom gig together for my local community. It was just sort of embracing the madness, and I've rolled with that. I have done a few Zoom gigs. I got offered a gig in, because the comedian's obviously here in Brighton, and they've booked some gigs in Brighton, and then they said, would you like to do Bath? And I went, no, I really wouldn't, thank you. And if that means I can't do Brighton, then I can't do Brighton either. Because I won't be travelling like I used to, because it actually made me miserable. I realised I was really miserable, really miserable. So there'll be a smaller orbit for a while. I'm quite happy
that's exactly how I felt. I felt like I was trying to keep up with everyone and everything. And I was like, well, everyone's touring, so I guess I should tour. But it wasn't in the early days when I first started. It would be like, I want to do an album, so I'm going to do an album. I want to do Edinburgh, so I want to do Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And then there becomes a point in your career where it's like, well, everyone does Edinburgh, so I guess we do Edinburgh. And it's not necessarily about what you think, but it's about what's expected or what everyone else is doing. And it was like this weird thing where I just did it because I wanted it, or I thought it was right. And then it was like, oh, so when this came along and it was like, it was like, oh, actually, I'm just going to take this time to think about what it is that I actually want out of my career now.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than trying to keep up with everyone. And when the Zoom gig started, it was like, I tried a couple, not immediately, but quite, and I didn't particularly enjoy them. And I have done some that I enjoyed, and I've done some that I haven't, but I haven't done loads. I've done maybe a handful. But there was a part of me that was at first, or at the beginning of my career, I was like, you know, I had all of these firsts out of my year group of, you know, I had my own TV show, and I was the first person to get like a Radio 1 special and all of this stuff. And I wanted to be, and then I got to this point and it was just like, I don't feel like I have to be the first person to save comedy by working out how to do it online.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I was just like, do you know what? I don't even want to be the first person to get their show on sale for when this is all over. And now I feel, you lot get comedy all sorted, and when it's all up and running, because you know, yeah. I've had so many false starts with this tour that it was delayed, 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 and then I cancelled it because I couldn't handle the pressure of that hanging over me.
Yeah.
You might have to tour in 3 weeks. And it's like, fuck, I've got to relearn the show. It was like that for a year.
Yeah.
And now it's just like, no, cancel it. And then when everything's up and running, I will write a show for that. And I'll join in with everyone else as and when. I don't need to be at the cutting edge or at the front. You know, I don't have to be a pioneer. I can just literally just like, what? Okay, I'll just join in when I'm ready, because that's what I want.
Yeah, and that'll ultimately make you happier as well. You know, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't miss the continued and endless sort of. I mean, I do this. We do it to ourselves, but the sort of professional jealousies that sort of were. A crappy side dish to, you know, the main meal of your career. It's really tiring. It's really tiring. And I think, yeah, the last year has sort of taught me, again, like you, just do what you want to do at the end. You know, I'm going to be 50 this year. So I'm kind of, you know, I'm thinking about not doing it eventually, you know, but it's nice to be able to just go, that doesn't make me happy, so I'm not going to do that.
Well, yeah, and also taking a moment to sort of like go, what am I doing? What are the, you know, before the pandemic, I was kind of like just incredibly unhappy, not with my career, but with what I was doing and the way I was trying to. You just like go, oh no, it's nice to have a moment to kind of like take a step back and go, what, you were only on this planet for a certain amount of years.
Oh.
And it's kind of like you can spend your whole time, you know, and I, at the beginning of my career, before I took off I'm talking like it wasn't like a stratospheric rise or anything, but like, but within my, but before
stratospheric,
but in a way, the 10 years of doing Edinburgh without an audience were the happiest years of my life.
Mm.
And that first Edinburgh when I didn't have any flyers, and I started selling out, and I couldn't work out why they were turning up. That was the best. That
would be the end of the movie, wouldn't it? That would be the end of the movie. You'd just get that.
Yeah. And then you've got to trudge along and go, oh God, I've got to crank out another show now. And it's just kind of like, and I've never felt like that, but those feelings have never been beaten. And so there's a point in the beginning of your career where you go, this is wonderful. But then you've kind of done that. And then you get sort of like sucked into the tornado where it's like, no, then, and you're forced to sort of like compete.
Mm.
And then it's like, I don't want to. I've never wanted to compete. I don't feel like I'm competitive. And even when we did this fucking stand up deliver thing, it was kind of like, I just want her to have like 5 minutes that she's not ashamed of, you know?
Mm.
So I think that having this time, you kind of like go, oh my God, I've been living someone else's dreams. Mm. Or someone else's, or a different version of my, of me's life. Mm-hmm. And actually, what is it that I want? And then you can kind of like go, oh yeah, I just want to slow down a little bit. Even if it's just for this period of time.
Yeah.
We're saying this, Zoe, but you haven't really slowed down. Or when was Lightning? When was that recording?
That was recorded in August. August.
So Lightning is your game show that you're doing.
Yes. Yes.
I've been watching non-stop game shows for the last month. talk to us. Why?
Yeah.
Because I'm mentally ill, Zoe, and it takes my mind off things, right?
Okay, nice.
But talk us through Lightning, right? What is it?
So
I've seen it, by the way, yeah. And it's really great, but tell us what it is.
So the premise of the show is it is a quiz. It's our contestants coming back over the course of a week, unless they get to the final and then they get a chance to win money. And the basic thing is timed amount of time. They have to answer questions. If they get a question right, they can nominate somebody to be in the light. And if you're in the light when the time runs out, you're eliminated. It's basically it's like a reverse sort of pass the parcel. If that makes sense. Yeah, 2-minute rounds, but they vary. Somebody starts in the light, when you get something right, pass the light, you get it right, pass the light, and if you're in the light when that time runs out, you're a goner. So there's various sort of strategies that people can play with it and stuff. It was very, very good fun to do. I loved it. I'd no idea I wanted to be a quiz show host, and then they put me in a shiny suit and put me in a studio, and I went, I've always wanted to be a quiz show host. This is what I want to do.
I do. It feels like such a big deal.
Yeah.
It's a massive thing, isn't it? Because you think, well, who else gets to do this? It's you're in now a very small group of people, a very small pool of...
And the funny thing is, like, we did so much prep, because obviously we did it in COVID, so there was lots of things that had to be altered and shifted and changed. And I'm a really bad reader. And obviously it's about reading questions, and we had to sort of work through that and how we'd sort of break things up so that my brain could read them. And then we got in the studio and we started, and I suddenly went, nobody's asked me if I can do this.
Was it a format? Was it an original format? Was it from another country or?
So how did it come about? So you filmed it in August. It all came about during COVID.
Yeah.
When did you first hear about it and what happened?
I got Christian, my agent, phoned me, I mean, the year before, because it all got delayed, and said, oh, I've got you a run through an audition for a game show. And I went, oh, great. And in my head went, that'll never happen. went along and did the run through. I got on really well with the producer. Well, I initially thought he doesn't like me. He really doesn't like me. I thought, I've got to find something that we can talk about other than telly that'll get things going. Anyway, it turns out he likes cars and I like cars. And I mentioned I just bought this car and his eyes lit up. And then we just started talking about cars. And then that was it. That was literally it. And then we got on really well and blah, 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 blah. And I think he championed me through then after that. It was like, I could have the job. So, yeah.
So when you say that it's a run through, so are we to assume that when they're setting this game show up, they've got a few people in mind that they test out to be the host?
Yeah. Yeah. I still don't know who the others were, actually.
Oh, I imagine.
You must ask them. Yeah.
You must ask them.
Yeah, I must ask. But I mean, I go into these things. I left the run through and my brain went, oh, shit. You know, you idiot. Go and stick your head in the bin. And, you know. About a month later, they came back and went, we loved you. And I went, wow, I just really don't know myself at all. I don't know myself. I don't know. I do often come away from things going, well, I mean, that'll be the last time you'll ever work. And then they're like, oh, we want you to do that again. I'm like,
That happens with sort of auditions where you go in and you think, I nailed that, and then you never hear from them again. Or you go in and it's like, that was fucking awful. And then you go, well done, you got the part. And you go, so I don't think that it's not for you to have any judgment in it.
Yeah.
It's literally for you to just go and do it and then forget that it ever happened.
Oh,
and then if it was all right, then you'll find out about it in 2 weeks' time. Do you know what I mean?
It's or weird, not. Though, isn't it? It's really weird. And I don't often get auditions, and I, you know, even less frequently. I don't often get the initial audition, and I very rarely get the job after the audition. So to do something like that and then get the job, I was like, wow, wow, okay.
But this means now someone is flicking through their channels and going, oh, I went up for that.
Yeah.
I was going to do Lightning.
Yeah, I was going to do that. I wouldn't have done it the way she did it.
How quickly do you... Because you, I guess, have to absorb the rules. And I think with when you're watching game shows or there's a new game show starting, I think it takes me 10 weeks before I fully understand the rules.
Work it out.
Yeah.
The thing with Lightning was it's actually quite simple. It's really simple. And you go, has this not been done before? You know, when something's so simple, you're like, this is really... Has this been done before? I mean, of course, it's been done in bits because it's been done before. But, yeah, the premise of the show was quite easy.
Well, it's a little bit like sort of a spin the bottle type thing, where it's who the thing lands on.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it's a little bit like it's nothing like Wheel of Fortune, but in the sense that it's kind of like there's a in the concept of you spin something and then it lands on someone. But in the case of this, it's like you have people that are nominating.
Yeah.
So, obviously, if there's someone that's rubbish at answering... So, there's an element of almost weakest link.
A little bit. And then there's obviously strategy, because do you want to get rid of the weakest person or the strongest person? And you can be brilliant at quizzing, absolutely brilliant, and then just, you know, have the light thrown to you and be out straight away. You might not even have time to answer a question. So, it is that, Jeopardy. We had some contestants that were... And as lovely as they were, I'm going to say they were... perhaps a little over ambitious in their own quiz abilities, and properly bad, and still managed to survive quite a long time. It's quite like that.
So you film 5 in a day, do you?
Yeah.
What's that like? So I'm watching a lot of The Chase.
Yeah.
And so they do, okay, so on the Sony channel, they show old episodes of Millionaire, from at like 11 o'clock until 1:30 in the morning. And at 1:30 in the morning on Sony, they start showing MASH. I'm not a fan of MASH. So then I switch over 2 channels up to Challenge TV, where as a secondary, I think Old Millionaire is the best.
Yeah.
And then as a secondary option, when Millionaire's off, I go into Challenge TV and I fall asleep watching The Chase.
Right.
I've grown up watching The Chase, but I'd never seen a whole episode until this the last month. So I didn't know what the rules were. And I've taught myself what the rules are recently.
Yeah.
And I know how it works, where they film like 5 episodes a day. And you can spot when Bradley's sort of like at the end of a day.
Yeah.
You know, when you're watching back to back like that, every night, 5 episodes ago, you can see the 5th episode where Bradley's like dead behind the eyes. He's still doing the chat, but basically the undercurrent of what he's saying is, yeah, let's play the game.
Yeah. It's utterly exhausting. And the thing is, because I'd never done it before and it was a new show, we had technical problems. So I wasn't supposed to film 5 a day. We were supposed to do like 2 a day and then 3 a day and then build up to 5 a day. But we had technical issues. So that had to be scrapped and we had to go straight into doing 5 a day. And I don't think I've ever been so tired.
Are there any things that you could tell us that if we were watching, we'd be able to tell which ones were the 5th one? Do you have any tells, like in poker?
No, I don't know. Actually, they were filmed in chronological order of when they were going. They were filmed Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So it'd be the Friday episodes. Whenever you're watching the Friday episode, and I'm like, ah, what bee is a flying in zero? When we did the last one, I just spontaneously burst into tears.
Yeah. I did a food show and we filmed an episode a day. And on the very first day, you're filming a whole episode in one day, which is awful. I don't recommend it. But but you, in your head, you're thinking, if that was shit, that's a whole episode that's shit. I'm learning on my feet. And if that episode if that day was shit, that whole episode was shit. So if you're doing five in a day and you're learning on your feet, did you find you learn episode by episode and you could actually see, you go, oh, okay, after the first one, you're kind of like, oh, I'm getting into this now. And by the end of the day, you were like, I am fucking nailing it. Or was it like at the end of the day, you go, well, that was a write-off. That's five high on level, you know.
We were pretty consistent. Do you know what I just kept thinking? I am tired. This is quite hard work. I don't really know what I'm doing. But I might not ever get this opportunity again, so I'm absolutely going to try and nail it. And so I kept so focused. And thankfully, they gave me lovely contestants as well, who had great banter. So it was quite easy. But... yeah, I just kept thinking, this is better than working in a factory or a warehouse or being a Chilean miner. This is better. Be grateful. And that just powers you through, doesn't it? Because you're working, you work your tits off for a week. You know, you get rewarded for it. So it's fine. You know, you've got to balance it up. It's not like you're coming out of it and they're going, and after tax and a sandwich, there's a fiver. So you're all right. You know, it's okay. You can get your mind around it. Yeah.
Is that also why, because you're doing something else, that means you don't have to do gigs in Bath that you don't want to do, right? Yeah. Because you've got something else going. I always think that's a thing where, I can say this to someone who's absolutely not successful whatsoever, but I always think that's perfectly reasonable. Like, I think there's this idea, isn't there, that people who do stand-up, it's got to be this sort of for the art of it, for the love of it.
Yeah.
And the idea of not doing it for a bit is almost seen a bit like, oh, you think you're too good for it now, do you?
Yeah.
There's a sort of weird snobbishness to it.
I'm just tired and I don't want to eat any more pasties in a low time.
But it's also, you kind of like go, you do stand-up all the time and then you get your quiz show and then you go back and you can use the success from the quiz show in order to sell tickets.
Yeah.
But you're selling tickets to people... that watch your quiz show. you know, it's like when I did Uncle, I sort of like, started doing gigs to people that are fans of Uncle, and they're all looking at me like, where's the little boy? And you're just like, it's different. I find that really weird. One of the things that I've noticed about game shows is I've been watching Wheel of Fortune, and Nicky Campbell is like full of like bants and stuff, and then you've got Carol Smiley, and then there's the guy that does the voiceover, and then he does stuff with it, and the game is very simple, but every time they come away from the game and do stuff, it gets really boring and you just like get back to the game. And when you watch The Chase, Bradley going like, what's your name, where are you from, what's your job, okay, that's interesting, back to the game. And you kind of like it's interesting. I've learned a lot about quiz shows. I find it really interesting how they all work. Do you enjoy it?
Do I enjoy being in it? Do I enjoy
the process of doing it?
Yeah, love it. I really love it. I love talking to them. I loved the contestants were just really good fun, and you've got to be a little bit mad to want to go on a quiz show, I think, haven't you? I mean, I don't know anybody who's been on a quiz show, and you're like, who goes on these things? And when you meet them, you're like, oh, it's people like you. Okay, fine, fair enough. You know, and I loved the slight cheesiness of it. I liked being a game show host. I did play it slightly cheesy. I had a shiny suit. I loved every bit.
Did you get to choose it?
We sort of chose it together. It's quite really interesting. It's what the general public were just affronted that I should wear the same suit. I mean, I had a couple of them, but, you know, it was like, it's an outfit. It's a uniform. It's, you know, it's a shiny suit. I can't wear that one week and then rock up in a pair of dungarees the following week. You know, if you're going for shiny suit, you've sort of hit, you know, you can't then just turn up in your shorts. You've got to keep the shiny suit.
But also that talking to the contestants is something that you will be absolutely accomplished in doing anyway, just from comparing gigs.
Yeah.
You're sort of perfect for the job without even knowing it.
Yeah.
Because you've had so much experience.
You know, because I run a gig here in Brighton, when we were allowed out, and every month, and because there were so many regulars there, I couldn't do material, so I had to just talk to them. So that skill is where that came from.
We've got 3 minutes. And then it's the end of the show. We've got to play a game with you, Zoe.
Right.
But I just wanted to say that I think the theme tune to Lightning is great. And Nathaniel, it sounds exactly like Claudio Simonetti. I told you that, Zoe.
Oh, yeah.
And so
oh, yeah.
You should both, Nathaniel, check out the theme tune to Lightning. And
I've
Zoe,
seen Lightning. I don't remember
out,
that.
Check out Claudio Simonetti because it's like he wrote the theme tune. Right, we're going to play a game with you now, Zoe. I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel. Nathaniel's going to take over. It's called Better or Worse.
Right. Okay, this is the game. It's better or worse. And you just have to say whether the next person on the list is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my own opinions to score points. Beginning with iced tea. Is vanilla ice better or worse than iced tea?
It's worse.
It's worse.
Worse. It's worse. Jackie Chan, better or worse than vanilla ice?
Better.
Better. Jackie Collins, better or worse than Jackie Chan?
Worse.
Worse.
Worse. Yes. Joan Collins, better or worse than Jackie Collins?
Better.
Better. Colin Firth, better or worse than Joan Collins?
Oh, he's better.
Better.
Yeah.
Colin Farrell, better or worse than Colin Firth?
Worse.
Worse. Spike Lee, better or worse than Colin Farrell?
Better.
Spike Lee.
Better. Better. Bruce Lee, better or worse than Spike Lee?
Oh, I'm going to say better.
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 Yeah.
Bruce Springsteen, better or worse than Bruce Lee?
Better.
Worse.
Worse than Bruce Lee, yeah. Bruce Willis, better or worse than Bruce Springsteen?
Oh, worse.
Worse. Yeah. I think it's a 10.
Yes!
It's a 10!
You got a 10! You got a 10! You got a 10! Oh, my God! That never happens! Oh, hell!
This is why you're so great at game shows.
I am so
oh, God! The host becomes the hosted, if that doesn't have any connotations. That's great. All right. So, right, this is brilliant. So you scored a 10, which means that you are the best that you could possibly be with Jen Brister, Thomas Coombs, John Coleshaw, Jason Manford, Jerry Scandini, and you're better than David Baddiel, Ken Cheng, Mike Drucker, Harry Hill, Dominic Monaghan, Luke Morley with 9, Matthew Crosby, Susie Dent, Charles Esten, Henry Fraser, Eddie Hearn, David Hepworth, Jason Isaac, Simon West, John Niven, Magical Bones, Samantha Morton, Matt Okai, Miranda Raisin, Griff Rhys-Jones, Chris Stark, Baroness Ayo DeVarsi, Stu Whiffen, Michael J. White and Gillian White with 8, Richard Herring, James King, Judy Lynn, Henry Normal, Janet Varney, Johnny Vegas with 7, Gary Delaney, Nell Frizzell, Frank Harper with 6 and Dave McLean, poor old Dave McLean with 5. Zoe Lyons, you're one of my favourite comedians. Thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Been Thank you for coming.
Talk to you for an hour. Welcome to the fan clubhouse. It's goodbye from me, Nick Helm. It's goodbye from Nathaniel. And it's goodbye Zoe.
Woo! Goodbye.
Yes. Everybody, look after yourselves. Look after each other. Wash your hands. We're not out of it yet, but we almost are. Take care. Goodbye. See you next week. Tell your friends.